This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Let's go to the south of France, where everyone's favourite film critic is probably sweating profusely, but still wearing a black suit and a tie and that famous quiff. Good afternoon to you, Mark.
Well, I'm not wearing a tie, but I am wearing a black suit, as is proven by the fact that we've got the vodcast crew are here. So you'll be able to see, I'm not making this up, I am sitting here in a black suit because I think it's very important to keep up standards. And can I start with a complaint?
Yes.
Okay, so the other day, I'm in this screening room, right, and James King's sitting next to me. And James, I say, how's it going, James? He says, oh, I think I finally understand what you mean about the weariness of Cannes. I really feel it's been very hard this year. And I said, oh, this is, I've started to sympathise with the child, because, hey, he's finally grown up into a man and realised that Cannes is a real ordeal, yeah? So then I found out this morning that we can't do this transmission now from Radio France, but we have to do it from the flat that James has been staying in. And James has led me to believe that he's been staying in some kind of student hovel and things are very, very difficult for him, exactly like I did when I worked for the radio for all those years doing the Cannes coverage. I get to James's flat. It's absolutely wonderful. He's got this bijou fourth floor apartment overlooking the Rue d'Antibes. It's far more central than the place I'm staying in. It's lovely and cool. It's really, really nice. I don't know what that boy is complaining about, and he's gone home already.
My assessment is that you have been spoilt. You've watched Pirates, and that's just put you in a bad mood. I know we haven't got there yet, but it sounds as though you're just in a grumpy frame of mind already.
No, I've got to tell you, the interesting thing, you know how grumpy I am about Cannes, right? And for years I've always said, Cannes, worst place on earth. I didn't see Pirates in Cannes. In order to see Pirates, I had to get on a train to go to Nice, because Nice was the place that was showing Pirates of the Caribbean in English. I could have watched it here in French, and frankly, I don't think it would have made that much difference. But I went on the train to Nice to see Pirates of the Caribbean, and at the end of it, I was so thrilled to get back into Cannes that my heart was suddenly full of joy.
Lots of Pirates conversation coming up. Your comments, because a lot of people will have seen it on those previews. The podcast is available. The vodcast will be available. We did it with pictures last week. Seemed to be rather successful, so we're going to do it again. And half of it will be in Cannes and half of it will be in Wentworth for
the very first time. So have you got a camera crew in your end as well?
As a camera and a cameraman, if that counts as a crew, yes.
Well, that's fine, because that means that they'll have to do it as like a split-screen thing. That'll be like a 60s homage. I think that's very cinematic. That's, 60th anniversary of Cannes, that's what it is,
That's the way to think about it. Let's take some travel, then we'll be back with the box office top 10 thoughts on Pirates 3 in a moment. 3:24, here's all... So, I have a whole raft of Pirates correspondence, Mark. What we'll do is, I think we'll hold on to these for a few moments' time. We'll do some news and sport, and then we'll do some pirate stuff, because a lot of people want to say a lot of things. So let's do the box office top 10.
Before you do the box office top 10, last thing on my complaint, right? As vodcast viewers will see, I'm literally sitting on a balcony surrounded by jasmine. I mean, the man has flowers. I've been staying in the Novotel. This is a total class distinction, and I demand that James King is fired immediately.
Box office top 10 this week. At 10, This England.
This is England. This England is obviously the abridged version. That's the 15-rated version that's showing only in Bristol, but This is England for everywhere else. Well, as you know, I think it's absolutely fabulous. I think that Shane Meadows is a terrific filmmaker, and it's a great evocation of 1983 Britain and a sort of reclaiming of skinhead culture and a terrific soundtrack. And you saw it, right?
I did indeed.
And you loved it?
I think it's very good. And the soundtrack just gets you straight away. And if you have been puzzled, as we mentioned at the time, as to why a lot of skinheads liked a lot of black music, it kind of answers that question, really.
It does, and I think it does that thing of reclaiming that culture and reminding everybody that there was a period before the NF or the BNP took over, and in fact it was a multiracial movement. And I think it's a really, really good film. I think it's Meadows' most confident film, so I'm glad to see it still in the top 10.
Number 9 is next.
I mean, we don't need it. It's on the way out, clearly. The gag is, he can see in the future, and you may get the sense that you've seen this one before, but I'm sorry, that's it. You may have heard that gag before, but that's the best that can be said about that film.
Mr. Bean's Holiday at number 8.
I take back everything I ever said about the French and their embracing of Charlie Chaplin and Jerry Lewis and Monsieur Hulot's Holiday, because the fact of the matter, I mean, I love Chaplin now. I used to be a real philistine with Chaplin, but I never got it with Monsieur Hulot. I never saw what was funny about Jacques Tati. And then I saw Mr. Bean's Holiday, and I suddenly realised that Jacques Tati is, in fact, a comic genius of quite staggering proportions, and we should all apologise publicly to the rest of the world for unleashing Rowan Atkinson on them. I mean, really, nothing sort of justifies that.
So just to clarify, you were wrong about Charlie Chaplin.
Oh, I was completely wrong about Charlie Chaplin. No, okay. No, hands up. No, I'm absolutely, that's not the, what I'm saying here is...
And Neil Young?
No, I was wrong about Neil Young as well. But
In fact, you're wrong about quite a few things.
No, Neil Young and Charlie Chaplin, that's two out of all the millions of things that I've been right about. But the thing I think that's more earth-shattering there is that I'm actually being quite positive about Jacques Tati, which I think really is staggering.
Wild Hogs at 7?
I mean, I don't need to see Wild Hogs. You know, nobody needs to see Wild Hogs. You sit there and you go, yeah, it's fine. I saw this before. It was called City Slickers and it was much funnier.
Love Wrecked at 6.
Now, one of the weird things about the lead up to Cannes is that your normal screening schedule is completely knocked out of whack, as a result of which I haven't seen Love Wrecked. Now, I have read some reviews of it, which have not been altogether favourable, but on the basis that one should never judge a film one hasn't seen, I am willing to accept that it having gone in at number 6, there is every possibility that it is Citizen Kane. I will see it next week, and then I'll give you a full verdict. But hey, you know, never prejudge anything, even when the reviews turn out to be less than great.
The Mitchell and Webb film Magicians is at number 5.
Did, however, see that, and it's a total stinker. And the real shame of it is this. Everyone assures me that show they do, what's it called,
Peep Show.
But you saw it, right? You like Peep Show.
Yeah, very good. It's very good.
And they came on the programme and they were nice. And
they come on many times. Always nice.
They do that advertising campaign, which is quite annoying, about PCs and Macs and all that stuff.
No, it's very good.
Yeah, well, Magicians is just all over the place. And it's the story of two rival magicians. At the beginning of it, there is a love triangle that results in a not very funny catastrophe. And then after that, it's down. It just looks like a television program stretched to 90 minutes. And the worst thing about it is it isn't even a television program. It's an original film idea that looks like a television program stretched to 90 minutes.
Number 4, Bridge of Terabithia.
Bridge to Terabithia. This is obviously yet another version of that famous movie.
No, this is Bridge of Terabithia. Have you not seen this one?
Is that the sequel?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a whole lot better.
It's the French translation, Le Bridge du Terabithia. Well, I mean, again, on the subject of me being wrong, we've had several people writing in saying that their kids were perfectly able to deal with the dark thing that happens two-thirds of the way through Bridge to Terabithia, which I felt that it hadn't earned the right to do. And I was concerned that I think an awful lot of kids would be upset by the dark turn that the story takes two-thirds of the way in. It's not that kids' stories shouldn't have dark turns, more of which when we get to Pirates of the Caribbean, but it's just that I didn't think this had justified it. However, several people have written in saying, hey, you know, my 8-year-olds have perfectly enjoyed this, and I'm obviously their experience is their experience. So there is the possibility of error.
Being wrong again.
No, being wrong. There's room for error.
Zodiac at 3.
Which, of course, is in contention here at... In competition here at Cannes. And I really like it. A serial killer movie without a serial killer at the centre of it. I mean, Fincher made 7 before, which was very sort of stylish, if a little bit empty, and was all about the serial killer. And this is a real-life story about the investigation of a serial killer. My only sort of reservation about the film is that in it, Robert Downey Jr. does that Robert Downey Jr. performance, in which he wears a funny facial hair and goes... And you go, Robert, I don't... Nobody other than you talks like that. Incidentally, the combination of Robert Downey Jr. and Chaplin was brought together when Robert Downey Jr. played Chaplin in that biopic Chaplin, and that was the point. At that point, I was very down on both Robert Downey Jr. and Chaplin, and I thought my world was imploding.
You're quite finished. Just nod when you're done. 28 Weeks Later at number 2.
It's great. It's absolutely great. I mean, nobody could believe that we would get a sequel that good to 28 Days Later, because the Danny Boyle original, which is not a zombie movie, as we know, they're not dead, they're infected, was really, really good. But I think Juan Carlos Fresnadillo has really done something with the franchise. He's made it into a political movie, and it's all about Iraq, and it's all about America. And yet, it is a full-on... you know, romping horror movie with wanton decapitation and loads of gore for the hardcore fans, which is me, and, you know, stuff to chew on and think about.
And the box office number 1, Spider-Man 3.
Yeah, well, if I could just get you to admit that actually you were lying when you said that you quite enjoyed it, and that actually what you were trying to do was just be nice. Because
I think last week was a spectacular example of the fact that just because you were sitting next to me, you thought you knew better about what I thought, whereas clearly I know what I thought, and I thought it was a bit disappointing towards the end, and I quite enjoyed it.
Well, as I said before, and I'm, you know, across the channel now, but I can still feel even now your body language is saying, if we wired you up to a lie detector, right, all the things would be going off the scale at the moment. You know how boring you found it. You know,
remember
how
that email that we got there was an email we got a couple of weeks ago which said, I loved Spider-Man. It was rubbish, but I loved it because it was Spider-Man. And there's the truth in
that. But you did, you know, that I believe. The person that wrote that in, I love it, but it was rubbish, but I love it. But you didn't love it. What you did was you did what actually a most sentient human being.
That's enough of Mark from Cannes, and we haven't even got to Pirates of the Caribbean 3, but there is a raft of correspondence which has reached Wentworth will correspond. We'll bring you the review. Mark has seen it. He sat through, is it 164?
It's 168 minutes.
Alex Neve in East Dulwich says, having just seen the third instalment of this nauseating franchise, I can safely assure the listening public that there is not a single element that suggests to me that we won't be getting a full-on Kermodian-style rant of the century. Put away your eye patches, give up your rum bottles, turn your radios up to 11. It's going to be an absolute screamer. Mark, what did you think of the new Pirates movie?
Well, I think it's important to say that one has to go into these things with an open mind, okay?
Oh, yeah, right.
No, I know. But look, okay. So, I mean, historically, the first Pirates movie was absolute bilge. And
wrong.
Ended up. No, it was. It was rubbish. And it ended up taking like $1 billion worldwide, which was really, really terrifying. The second one was kind of worse because it was longer and it was a holding pattern because it went on for like in 150 minutes and nothing happened. I mean, a bunch of stuff happened, but nothing actually happened. Just a bunch of stuff happened. And then when it came out on DVD, and I said to everybody, you know, you should boycott this movie. If this stuff does well, it's your own fault. Then it came out on DVD and I was told this terrifying fact that it was the fastest selling DVD of all time. Somebody, it may even have been you, said that on the day that it was released, 1 in 5 DVDs that were sold was Pirates of the Caribbean 2. So now we have the opening weekend this weekend of Pirates 3. It's starting to preview on Wednesday, and we've already been told by the industry the prediction is this is going to be the biggest box office weekend of all time, because we have Pirates 3 opening, you have Shrek the third, and you have Spider-Man 3, which completely, you know, ludicrously has done better than the other two movies, because as you know, Spider-Man 3 is a real bore, and your body agreed with that even if what you said didn't agree with it. So I have to go to Nice firstly. So I go to Nice to see, you know, in version original. And I'm really heartened because I get into the cinema. There's only 4 other people in the cinema. It's a 2 o'clock screening. Okay, admittedly, it's an English screening in France, but there's quite a lot of English-speaking people in France. It was largely Americans in the 4 o'clock. So you sit down, okay? Think, okay, we're here for 168 minutes. Film starts off with a hanging sequence, a sequence in which a whole bunch of people are hanging, you know, including underage person, but probably the most misjudged opening of any allegedly family-friendly movie I've seen in a long time. You're sitting there thinking, this is, they've totally lost the plot. They've decided to go dark for the, you know, for the third Pirates movie. What on earth are they playing at? This is not something that needs to go dark. This is something that needs to lighten up a little. This is something that actually needs, you know, to be entertaining. But no, we have this really long, really sort of drawn out, really completely out of place hanging sequence at the beginning. And the BBFC guidelines, so I looked it up, says contains moderate horror and action adventure violence. So he said contains, you know, completely inappropriate darkness at the beginning that is absolutely out of kilter with the rest of the film and has no right being there. Fine. So we get through that. Then, after the opening sequence, the plot, or more precisely, the plots start. And if you remember any of the plot threads that were at the end of Pirates of the Caribbean 2, it's like, oh, well, somebody's got to go off and find a heart, somebody's got to find an island, somebody's got to get a treasure map, somebody's got to get a compass, somebody's got to sing a song, somebody's got to stand on their head and turn around 38 times. That, or Blundo Land has got to go and find his dad for some reason that's not clear to anybody, but other than the fact that Stellan Skarsgård is clearly picking up the check and he's a great actor, so I'm happy that he's employed. So, it starts. And it goes on a little bit, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm really dreading the moment that Johnny Depp's going to come on and do that Keith Richards impression that we all know wasn't funny the first time and really wasn't funny the second time. And here we go, he's going to do it the third time. And then the movie plods along with, you know, Keira Knightley and Orlando Bland and all the rest of it all happening, and no Johnny Depp. It's 35 minutes before Johnny Depp actually arrives on the screen. And I'm starting to think this is really clever, because what they've done is they've realised that Johnny Depp is so terrible in the film that they're withholding him. They're withholding him because actually everything else in the film is going to do better without him. But no, 35 minutes in, Johnny Depp turns up. But not just one Johnny Depp, 10 Johnny Depps turn up at the beginning. And there's a brilliant line in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which is referring to Arthur Dent meeting up with Hoojama Flip, the Martin Freeman character, and he says he's one of those people that you couldn't see him for months at a time, and then as soon as you saw him, he was immediately annoying. And Johnny Depp in Pirates of the Caribbean 3 is exactly, but he's immediately annoying squared. He's immediately annoying to the power 10, because there are 10 of him. And there's a little bit of business about, oh, Johnny Depp's dead, but he's in the underworld. All this stuff seems to exist purely to show off the fact they've got a special effect that can turn a stone into a crab. Great, brilliant, marvellous. Not enough to hang a feature film on, but hey, well done to the special effects guys. Then they escape from the underworld that he got into at the end of the last movie, because I think Kira killed him, but I can't quite remember. There was something to do with a kraken. And then they all get together and they say, okay, off we go on the various plot strands again. And it's business as usual. There's actually one line this where somebody says one person has the 9th piece of 8, which is just about as coherent as any form of plot synopsis gets. On the IMDb trivia page, it says the most amazing thing about Pirates 3 is that they started filming without a completed script. No, they finished filming without a completed script. So they just ended up with like a montage of bits, a whole bunch of special effects, a little bit of him doing that, a little bit of everyone else, and they just stuck them together in any order, and they didn't cut any of it out, just said, there's 168 minutes, shove it out into the cinema, and everyone will buy it, because everyone has clearly had some kind of terrible, you know, joint lobotomy, so that nobody any longer has the guts to stand up and say, this is absolutely terrible, and what we're doing here, actually, we should walk out of the cinema and go next door where they're showing Zodiac. However, Johnny Depp leads to the problems. Let's start with Keira Knightley, because clearly Keira Knightley's agent has been speaking to the scriptwriters and saying, look, it's fabulous. We're really pleased that Keira's back in the movie again. Obviously wonderful. The thing is, up until now, she has really been window dressing. And what we really think is that Keira needs to sort of expand her role. And why don't you make Keira a pirate? Because I think really she could do pirate. So through the most ridiculous, contrived, plot device, Keira Knightley actually ends up being king of all pirates in all the world ever. So Keira Knightley, king of the pirates. This means that Keira Knightley has to do two things. Firstly, she has to do the pirate ha-ha-ha-ha. But of course, when Keira Knightley does it, it's like, hello, ha-ha-ha-ha. Then she has to do a rabble-rousing speech, which is basically like that speech that Mel Gibson does in Braveheart about, you know, they can take our lives, but they can never take her freedom. Only when Keira Knightley does that speech, it basically sounds like the head girl addressing a convention of fifth formers on prize-giving day at the end of term. So Keira, disastrous, given more to do, messes it up terribly. And then we have the magisterial talent of Orlando Bland. Now, there has always been a problem with Orlando, which is that very early on, the script had a relationship between the Keira Knightley character and the Orlando Bland character. Nobody at that point realized that the minute you got Orlando Bland on screen, nobody would care what happened to him. He's so wet, he's so drippy, so completely ineffectual, nobody cares about him. So in the second one, there was this sort of attempt to make the Keira Knightley character somehow interested in the Johnny Depp character, because everybody else in the audience, other than me, was interested in the Johnny Depp character and kind of didn't care what happened to Orlando Bland. So this time we have to take Orlando Bland, take some kind of interest in him. Now he's acting this love interest against Keira Knightley. Now Keira Knightley's acting has always been wooden, but this time it is like a petrified forest of woodenness. I mean, you really feel like you could build a very nice piece of IKEA furniture out of her performance. It's that bad. And when she and Orlando Bland are on screen together, it's like watching two chairs mating. I mean, there's a scene in which they have to kiss, and it's literally, what is that? Is that a nest of tables? No, it's Orlando Bloom and Keira Knightley having sort of some red-hot, passionate embrace that is positively tiki. I mean, you feel like you need to get out of the varnish and varnish it. Now, I'm going to give away a plot point now. If you're going to sit through Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End, and never was a film more accurately named, turn your ears away from the radio now, because there is a moment towards the end of this film in which it is contrived to have Keira Knightley can get married to Orlando Bloom, but she can only see him for one day in every 10 years. I'm sorry. If somebody made me that offer, I'd take it right now. If somebody said to me, if I marry Orlando Bloom, you won't have to see him again for another 10 years. And when you do, it's like, do you take this man? Yes, absolutely. I will take him right now. If I only have to see him one day every 10 years, sign me up. Because I don't think I can stand another moment of sitting there in the cinema watching this dribblesome bore, you know, waltz around like somebody out of a milk tray advert. I mean, how on earth has he become the prominent actor that he has? I mean, he killed Kingdom of Heaven stone dead. And in this, he's actually got worse than before. And then we have the mighty Johnny Depp performance. So Johnny Depp started off doing this performance as basically Keith Richards, although actually he wasn't really doing Keith Richards as far as I can tell. He seemed to be doing David Bowie around the period of The Laughing Gnome. Everyone says, oh, it's a great impression of Keith Richards, but it didn't sound like David Bowie, hello, I'm the Pirate King, Jack Sparrow. That's not Keith Richards, that's David Bowie. But the big gag with Pirates of the Caribbean 3 is, guess what, Keith Richards is actually going to turn up. So you sit there and you fall asleep and you wake up and you fall asleep and you stretch your back a little bit and you feel most of your lower body starting to go numb, and then about 2 hours the way through, Keith Richards turns up. And here's how it goes. Keith Richards goes, and Johnny Depp goes, and Keith Richards goes, if you thought Johnny Depp was bad at being Keith Richards, you should see Keith Richards trying to be Keith Richards. I mean, there was a ripple of sort of appreciation in the audience, which, as far as I could tell, was entirely for the fact that Keith Richards was still alive at all. But he's even worse at doing an on-screen Keith Richards than Johnny Depp is. And between them, this sort of, you know, incredible in-joke about, oh, it's so funny, up until now I've been doing Keith Richards, and now here he actually is. It's like, no, all of you, the Rolling Stones don't care, go away. I mean, you know, I never want to see the Rolling Stones. I don't want to ever see another Pirates of the Caribbean movie, despite the fact that at the end of this, there is a door left open for there to be another one. The whole thing goes on forever. I added this up, right? First movie 142 minutes, second movie 150 minutes, this 168 minutes. I make that the best part of 8 hours of my life. Stanley Kubrick went from the beginning of civilization to, you know, the dawn of a new breed of human being in just over 2 hours. This has taken them 8 hours to get from point A to point A. It's enough. It has to stop now. And really, if you go, you know, if you pay money to go and see Pirates of the Caribbean, it's your own fault, and you're bringing down the collapse of Western civilization. And I had it a feeling in my waters that actually Gore Verbinski was going to pull it out of the bag and do something that would make me have to say I'm wrong. But you know what? I am so right. It is so bad.
I haven't been on for 15 minutes. I've been to the 17th tee and I checked on the leaderboard. Let me know when you're done.
You asked, I'm done.
It's 10 to 4. There's some correspondence here. This is from Vince in Winchester on Pirates. Why on earth, he says, does this film exist? Pirates 1 was boring, Pirates 2 was confusing and annoying, but Pirates 3 is on another level altogether. The film opens with scenes you would expect to see in a concentration camp, with lines of people slowly marching to be executed, whilst to the side a stack of bodies increases in size, as does the pile of shoes next to it.
Exactly.
Then he puts in capital letters, "This is meant to be a film for kids." I gave up all hope when I noticed the little boy who was about to be executed had a nice shiny set of 21st century braces on his teeth. Amazingly, the film goes downhill from here. One, the film was long. Two, it wasn't slightly funny. Three, Orlando Bloom reminded us once again his acting talent has the emotional depth of a teaspoon. Four, what little character development has been made in the first two films was forgotten entirely. Worst of all, the film had no plot or structure at all, just lots of explosions, incomprehensible plot twists, stupid digitally imposed Johnny Depps and Keith Richards turning up and a hammer the joke home start strumming a guitar. Instead of using the good doctor's death of narrative cinema line as I left the packed screening that I was at, I instead declared I'd give £50 to anyone who could tell me what the plot of the film actually was. And no one could. I now fully understand the Doctor's hatred of these films. Pierce in Dublin. I went to see the new Pirates movie yesterday. A lot of huff and puff about goodness knows what. Never thought I'd see a film where the two best performances are delivered by Keith Richards and a monkey. Can someone please tell Johnny Depp to get back to acting? This from Harry. Saw Pirates. It's an awful, awful, awful film. The worst thing about it, and there are so many things to choose from, is that its sheer dreadfulness will make Mark reiterate how right he was about the franchise when he is completely wrong about the original film, which is amusing and entertaining, although going by the sequels, that was probably a bit of an accident by all involved. And I agree with that. It also feels as if Mark's comments about the previous films had been relayed to Gore Verbinski as suggestions, and consequently we have a script that feels as if it was written the evening before filming began, a plot that would have David Lynch scratching his head, excessive gurning from Johnny Depp standing in for humour, and Orlando Bloom's breathless acting. Whilst the ending of the film will have Disney's shareholders crossing their fingers, I suspect Mark will probably want to repeat his infamous Cannes performance and start swearing at the screen. Is that what you did?
No, I didn't. I sat very, very quietly because, I was out of my own territory. And, going bonkers in Cannes is one thing, but going bonkers in Nice, I don't know what happens. I don't know whether you get arrested and thrown in the slammer. Also, there's really no point in shouting at the screen when, there's four people in the auditorium and actually I could just quietly get up and leave. When I was shouting at the screen with Cannes, actually what I was shouting at was my disapproval at the fact that this idiot audience were applauding this terrible movie by Lars von Trier. And so I was, that was the point at which I lost. But also, I think I'm beyond being angry with Pirates. I mean, that first email was absolutely exactly on the money. As I said, that opening sequence is just about the most badly misjudged opening sequence for a family film I can possibly imagine. You do not use that kind of imagery lightly. You do not do that. You have to earn the right to do that sort of stuff. And it's completely out of place. And considering the film is so long, and anyway, that opening sequence has no relation to the rest of the plot, other than at some point somebody says, oh yes, the singing has started. You remember that the singing started at the gallows, but I don't know what relevance that has to anything. Sorry, no, take it out. Lose 10 minutes, get on with the rest of the film. Although the rest of the film is rubbish as well.
If you want to watch this rant, there's the vodcast. It should be available from Monday. You can hear again everything in detail on the podcast. Len, on this email on the subject of Pirates, just to clarify things,
yes,
did Mark like it or not?
I thought it was all right. No, I mean, it's here's the most amazing thing about it. I didn't think it was possible for it to be as bad as it was. I really didn't think. You just kind of assume the budget for it apparently was $200 million. Right? That makes no odds because it's going to take $1 trillion and then they're all going to come out of it laughing and we're going to get Pirates 4 and yadda yadda yadda. And Gore Verbinski is going to, leave the noughties as the most financially successful director the decade has ever produced, which is a really shocking indictment of the state of society at the moment.
But Mark, can you... Oh, go on.
I was going to say, but I never thought it could be that bad.
Mark in Newcastle. Last night I saw Pirates at my local cinema. I left wanting 3 hours of my life back.
Yeah, exactly.
The film had no direction, relied on the same old humour and action, which has become very stale. If it wasn't for the sheer confusion happening before my eyes, I would have fallen asleep. The final battle scene would have saved it if it wasn't for the cheesy marriage scene halfway through. At the end, everyone cheered, and I sat there wondering what they were on and hoping I would never have a chance to try it out. On the plus side, Barbossa's return and Davy Jones provided some good acting, and Keith Richards' small part was far better than Orlando Bloom throughout the entire film. If anyone is going to see a movie this weekend, save your money and avoid pirates. Is there anything else?
Well, there's Ginderbine, and Ginderbine, funnily enough, I saw at Cannes this time last year. It's a lovely little Australian movie. Well, not lovely, a very dark and interesting Australian movie. And in fact, when we were at the Edinburgh Film Festival, when the show was coming for the Edinburgh Film Festival, I think you were off somewhere. It was being presented by somebody else, but Gabriel Byrne was on the show, on your show, in your absence, and he was talking very intelligently about it. It's a really, really interesting piece of work from the guy who directed Lantana, and it's based on a Raymond Carver short story, which is called So Much Water, So Close to Home, which did you ever see Shortcut, Simon?
Remind me.
You know the Robert Altman film, which is like based on Raymond Carver's short story? Okay, fine.
No.
Well, there's one sequence in it, which is a story about a group of guys who go fishing, on a fishing trip, and when they arrive at the place they want to fish, they find a body in the water. And they've got a choice, which is either they can immediately go home and inform the authorities, or they can fish for the weekend and then go home and inform the authorities. And they decide to fish for the weekend because, hey, they're there. And when they then get back to their families are quite rightly appalled by what they've done, by the fact that they've sort of been heartless in this way. And it's about the ramifications, about what then happens. And this is based on the same short story, but it expands it. It starts off with what appears to be like almost like a serial killer narrative. And then it basically concentrates on the central relationship between Gabriel Byrne and Laura Linney as this couple falling apart. And when we were talking about it on the show, I said to Gabriel Byrne, look, I really love this film. I really liked it. It's been a year now since I saw it. It's taken a long time to get distributed. You know, is it a hard sell? And he said, well, the problem is you're in a marketplace nowadays when what people want from cinema is stupid explosions, you know, stupid lack of plot. Everything's aimed at a totally infantile mind. People aren't attuned to the idea of sitting down and watching a grown-up movie with real people having real problems and dealing with real issues. Well, that's what Ginderbine is. It's a really, really impressive, dark drama, you know, that's about the real problems that people face, and it's very enjoyable. I mean, enjoyable in a, you know, dark and disturbing way, but a really good piece of work. And I think it actually speaks highly of the distributors that they've put it up against Pirates. It's not competing with Pirates of the Caribbean. It's not saying, you know, oh, you're going to have a decision. What should we go? It's saying, no, I'm sorry, Pirates of the Caribbean is over in another world. This is called contra-programming. In a week in which Pirates is going to be stuffing up every single multiplex screen near you. You know, if you don't want to have anything to do with that, if you want a really good alternative, go and see Ginderbine. And again,
hang on, before you get to the movie of the week and hold everyone, you know, just there, Ian Carter, while we're at Wentworth, last moment from you, get it in quick.
Top of the leader. He's alongside Ross Fisher in second place.
This could go any way. Mark Kermode in Cannes, what is the movie of the week?
Between Pirates of the Caribbean or Ginderbine?
Yes.
It's a toughie, isn't it? That would be Ginderbine then, wouldn't it?
This text from Tim, I'm exhausted but satisfied. Thank you, Mark.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.